Okay, well, let's start with saying that Representative Davidson is here and Mr. Grunberg is here and Mr. Martin and Mr. Miller and myself, Peter Gall, and this is the House Judiciary Committee. It's quarter two. It's Thursday, the 4th of May. If you would correct yesterday's record, Deb, to show that all members except, I believe, Mr. Miller were here yesterday. Is that right? Mike, were you here yesterday?
No.
All members were present except Mr. Miller yesterday. Okay. We're going to revise our order of bills as follows. The first bill we're going to take up is SB 123. The second bill is going to be SB 202. The third bill is going to be SB 204, SB 86, SB 250, if the university shows, SJR 43, SB 207, SJR 3, and finally HR 7. HR 7 may end up not being heard, and we will try to go till 3:30. Unfinished business, such as it is, will include tomorrow. House Bill 173, is that the number?
SB
173, and what's the other one?
HR 7.
And HR 7 if the sponsor requests. Other than that, we will not be meeting tomorrow. Okay, Senate Bill 203. Melissa, would you be here to join us? I mean 123, I'm sorry.
No. I want to...
Okay, we're going to now have on the record a little discussion between Representative Grunberg and the representative of the sponsor. Representative Davis is here. Senate Bill 123 was heard by the committee at the beginning of the week, and our testimony and discussion is done. Mr. Grunberg has some proposals, and we're going to hear from him at this time.
You got both?
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I think we have basically two amendments that I hope the sponsor agrees with. And they're very simple, very easy. Page one is okay. Page two is okay. Page three, I would like to offer this amendment, and maybe call this amendment number one, the short one.
So we're working off the judiciary CS. Is that right? Senate Judiciary
CS. This little amendment I'm giving off up here is called amendment number one. And all it does, it should be a technical amendment, that simply says that all of these corporate, non-profits, charitable corporations, charitable associations, or charitable trusts must be tax exempt under 501c3. And that's so that they're legitimate and they've been given an IRS tax exempt status. I think it's a technical amendment, and I wouldn't do it.
Is there objection? Hearing no objection, amendment number one has been adopted. Amendment number two.
Okay. This next is the two amendments. You got it? Okay.
Two pages?
Uh-huh. And the first amendment is very simple, and it is one line. So the thing on page four, line 13, Mr. Chairman, should be considered amendment number two. And the last thing I'm going to offer today.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Well, this bill is a whole structure.
Yeah, just we're in recess here.
You can read the amendment.
Okay. Mr. Grunberg, on amendment number two, do I understand you're taking the top little section first here?
Yeah.
Okay, so would you move amendment number two?
I move amendment number two.
Is there any objection to that?
Mr. Davis? Well, let me explain what it does. Okay. What it simply does is on page four, line 13, says that the municipality may, by ordinance, require that if the land is sold, etc. In other words, to effectuate this, the municipality must pass an ordinance, and they can draft the ordinance as they wish within the contours of this section. In other words, this becomes now a local option, and the local option will state that a municipality, since this deals with recapture, can say, yes, we do want to recapture, these are the terms and conditions, this is the amount that the owner will have to pay the way it will be set up. And it leaves it in the hands of the municipality.
Yeah. Are objections maintained?
Yeah.
Mr. Davis?
Well, I'm just trying to see how it meshes together. Mr. Chairman, this first time I've put this draft.
Take your time.
There's no rush. I understand he's just first moving this section up here.
Right. So page 3, line 13,
Go to the original House Senate Judiciary Bill. Forget that CS, which was never adopted. And and go to the Senate Judiciary Committee substitute for Senate Bill 123. And that's where his class should be.
And so the sentence will say, Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Gruenberg,
that the municipality may by ordinance require that if the land is sold, leased, or otherwise disposed of for uses incompatible with the conservation easement or if the conservation easement is conveyed to the owner of the property, the owner shall pay to the municipality an amount equal to the additional tax of the rental levy, together with 8% interest for 10 years of rental land having been doing this. In other words, it leaves it up to the municipality how they want to deal with it. The municipality may not care, but if they do, they have the authority. And the sponsor,
Our objections maintained?
No.
Hearing no objection, amendment number two is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, amendment number three amends a related. There's one section of law dealing with conservation easements in the entire code, and this is it right here. I move amendment number three.
Amendment number three has been moved by Mr. Gruenberg. Do you have copies of the amendments?
Right. And what we're doing is simply making this congruent here. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm moving amendment number three, except I am striking the phrase on the little underline thing that says under AS 34.17. That's not being offered, because you could offer an easement, a scenic easement, but not follow this act. They could just have done it on their own. So most scenic easements will be under here, but a few may not. This definitely will relate to the subject of the bill. And this is the present language, and what we're saying here is that we're basically using the same concept we used here and putting it in this other section, too, so that everything is congruent with the bill. The entire statutes on the subject are totally congruent.
Let the record show all members are present. Are there any objections to amendment number three?
Let me ask you a question. Why, under what authority are they granting this provision if they aren't granting it under AS 3417?
That was my original question, Representative. But it is possible. It is possible that they could grant an easement.
I just want you to call me on the names. Go ahead.
I thought you were Senator.
The esteemed, the honorable. Generally, it will be under this, but I think it is possible. Andy and Melissa, correct me if I'm wrong. It is possible to have an easement that it would be scenic conservation or public recreation that doesn't meet the requirements of this.
If I may, through the chair, I talked to an attorney general yesterday.
I'm so sorry, would you state your name for the record?
Oh, Melissa Faust, representing Senator Strzelecki. I talked to an attorney general who deals in eminent domain yesterday, and he says that there are other kinds of easements that are existing and possible that wouldn't fall under the definition of the conservation easement.
Should we want to exclude the conservation?
All conservation easements will fall under here, but there may be an occasional other easement that's not technically a conservation.
Fine.
I move the amendment.
Objections?
No objections.
Hearing no objections, amendment number three is adopted. Is there any discussion on the bill? Is there any further amendments? Anybody wish to testify? Anybody have questions?
Just one thing. Ms. Faust, am I correct that the sponsor of the bill supports the amendments in the CSE?
Through the chair, yes, sir.
Thank you. I just wanted that on the record.
Anybody want to make a motion?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. F.
If there's no further discussion, I'll move the Judiciary Committee substitute for Senate Bill 123. Move on.
Further objections?
I appreciate everybody's patience.
It is always a pleasure, sir, to have our bills improved by your razor-sharp legal mind. I've got some ideas, and I think what we need to do is strategize and maybe even speak to our friend Mr. Davis and Mr. Ellis. I'd like to just indicate to the committee that, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with other mechanisms, but Johnny's Hess Committee, on which two of us sit, is working on high-cost issues. This Judiciary Committee is going to be working on insurance issues. Mr. Donnelly has been working on tort issues. And I'm going to recommend to Mr. Ellis that he consider utilizing a part-time staff person to coordinate, you know, an intercommittee effort to try to get legislation before the body next year. I just want to let everybody know that I'm going to be having that conversation in case you have interest in it. Let's see here.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Gruenberg,
I've talked to some of you about some of my questions about certain sections in the Corporations Code, not the stuff that the native groups are concerned with, not the stuff that Card Don Stevens, it's going to take a couple of minutes. So I've asked the chairman to put this a little farther down on the calendar so we can pump out some of these shorter bills in the meantime. And I want to go over with you, but I...
Can I digress here for one moment?
Of course.
Because I know Johnny's got this legislation that can't probably work sort of aiming, going down the chute here as far as the chairman. And I'm just curious if... And you also sit on which other committees?
We both sit on Hess and Johnny.
And I sit on Labor and Commerce. So between the three of us, are we going to... Do we have the time and is there legislation that seems like the three of you... The three of those three committees are sort of crucial in terms of getting some legislation on the floor.
Right.
Are we going to be able to make it with the bills that we have?
I think we can.
Wait,
this is the last
following. Are we going to be able to
make the bills that are necessary for adjournment?
Yeah. There are no bills in this committee anymore that are necessary for adjournment that I know of. And we're just going to try to continue our work through this week and go home for the summer.
This is the last day.
This is our last calendar day. We've got to finish business tomorrow and summer. Talk about our interim work. We're in good shape.
Right.
In fact, if you take a look, members of the committee might be interested to know that if anyone would like a list of the bills we consider, the bills that are still in committee, the bills that have passed through, you'll find that we haven't exactly met the voucher test, but we've certainly moved a lot of legislation through this committee. Mr. Schwenken, you know, and while I'm speaking personally, I just would like very, very much to thank each of you. This has been a very rewarding experience for me. I haven't always shown that possibly, but it's really been a pleasure and a privilege to serve with each of you and to deal with the matters we've dealt with. And I just want to thank you for your attention and your goodwill. Yes,
Mr. Chairman, by request of at least two members of your majority staff,
yes, sir.
Could we have a hearing on taxing of drugs and marijuana?
I think probably
it's
we're
committee.
Kind of running out of time this year, but we certainly...
That's what I'll ask one more time for you. But if it,
yeah, well, I was thinking, Terry, next year we would probably have enough substance abuse issues on the table to give you quite an opportunity.
You might not have me next year if the committee gets rid of me.
Terry Martin, I think if anybody can withstand the assault of the Ethics Committee, it's going to be...
Let's roll on some of these.
Okay, enough of this. Are you ready for 202, or are you ready for 204? Not yet.
No, I want to kick some of these out. Take a few minutes to talk about
it. Okay, let's take a look at 202 and see how you all feel about that. We haven't made any commitments about anything on that bill except to hear it, so it's open for your consideration.
Mr. Chairman, I think the ones that would be quick, at least three.
Yeah,
well, then we do two.
Yeah, no problem. Okay. With that, is there anybody here who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 202?
Thank you. If there were here, I could put it in a word for it. Did you have any amendments?
No, I just I think that it wouldn't hurt to have the sponsor show up and tell us a little bit about it, though.
You want me to call?
I can say something.
Do you want to speak to the bill?
Yeah, it simply adds another sentencing enhancement factor that if you're over the age of 18 and you induce somebody who's younger than 18 to participate in planning or committing the crime, the court may consider it as an aggravated.
Oh, I do have an amendment. Yes, yeah. I do have an amendment. Mr. Chairman, I would like to, I'm sorry, Max, I would like to amend this bill. If we're going to move it, and specifically, I'd like to use the same provision that is used for other statutory crimes like this, where the age of the victim in the case of sexual assault and the age of the person being corrupted, if you will, is 3 years younger than the person doing the corrupting. I'd like to avoid having an 18-year-old and a 17-year-old committing a crime together and having them be treated so very differently based on what might be a small age difference. And what I'd like to recommend to the committee is that this be in effect for people who are 21 years of age. For example, I guess that's all there is to say.
I'll offer the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Gruenberg moves that we replace 18 on line 11 with 21.
Well, I thought you were saying would be the follow-up. Check me if I'm wrong. The defendant, being 18 years of age or older, and 3 years older, and at least 3 years older than a person under the age of 18, knowingly induced, caused, or permitted that person to participate in planning or committing an offense.
I would be very interested in hearing the thoughts of the members of the committee on which approach seems preferable to you. It seemed to me that having some age difference, so that one person was clearly more mature than the other, made sense. My first thought was, why don't we say anyone who's over 21 who uses a minor
is guilty of this crime or this aggravating circumstance. Mr. Gruenberg suggests a three-year difference, which essentially would pick up people 18, 19, and 20 who are, you know, dealing with minors. But anybody over 21 who deals with somebody over 18 is covered under either case. The difference would be people 18, 19, or 20 in relation to people 16, 17, and 18, I guess, or 15, 16, and 17. Mr. Miller, Mr. Davis?
My memory could be refreshed. Totally slips me right at the moment. What age do they now, or are they treated automatically as an adult?
On statutory rape type things, in other words, where legal consent is the issue, 16. Where you're talking about sexual abuse of a minor, the victim must be under 16 and the perpetrator must be at least 3 years older than the victim. Right. When it comes to voting rights and the, quote, age of majority, we're speaking of 18 generally.
Okay, so
when it comes to alcohol, of course, we're speaking of 21.
Man 1 is 19.
And, you know, I'd support you bringing that up to 21, if I thought we could just leave it at that.
So if somebody goes in and say you have, say, two separate cases, somebody 16 goes and robs a liquor store, or somebody's 18, the 18-year-old would automatically be tried as an adult, mm-hmm. and the 16-year-old would be considered a juvenile unless they ask for it to be tried as an adult. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have any thoughts, Mike, about the choice between the three-year difference and the age 21? Again, the only people that would be affected by that choice are perpetrators 18, 19, and 20 who wouldn't be counted here if we use the age 21, whereas perpetrators 18, 19, and 20 would be counted if there was a three-year difference under massive language. I guess my own personal thought is that when you're talking about not corrupting a minor specifically, but using a minor in your own crimes, that there should be a certain maturity before you consider it an aggravating circumstance. It seems to me that two kids playing together, if you can call an 18-year-old a kid, or committing a crime together, is a real different circumstance from somebody 21 or older using someone under 18. So. Mr. Dave?
Well, you know, I think that amendment or departure from current law would be something that I would want to have people from the AG's office to testify on that, because I can see the three-year window when we're looking at sexual assault statutes, but when someone 17 and someone 20, are in some criminal activity, whether it's robbery or whatever, criminal mischief, I just think that, or 16 and 19, I don't think those same kinds of thought apply to those kinds of conduct as they would perhaps between two adults, male, female, consenting or non-consenting adults. So I think that's a big departure, and I think I'd like to have a sort of full hearing on that issue.
Before we make a decision there. I tend to favor the 21 myself. Thinking about what you're saying, it seems to be a 19-year-old man. Sir, Mr. Morton.
Well, I think that we've gone and made it that the age of responsibility, pretty well traditionally all over the nation now, is 18. And the big freedom of escaping from high school and so forth are matured. Probably most of the people 19 and older, that's over 18, are out of their homes, probably working in service, to college, whatever, and have every freedom of an adult that's 40 or 50 for all practical purposes. And, if they're going to have the freedom of adulthood, they also have responsibility of adulthood. And to treat them differently just because they're 19 or 20, instead of 21 and older, I'm not so quite sure. Sure, you gain a little more knowledge by the time you're 21, but I'd have this responsibility on the individual. Anyway, we don't mind you going above and dealing with people your age, but when you get below, there's a certain responsibility of your conduct and what you encourage younger people to get involved in.
You know, Terry, maybe one way to deal with it, instead of playing around with the first reference to 18, go down to the second one and say that, you know, if a person 18 years of older, using that same age of consent that we do with sexual abuse, and say that being 18 years of older induces someone under 16.
Yeah.
You know, might be another way of looking at it. A couple of members have indicated they want to think about this. I'd like to get Mr. Hemingway, who's spoken to the sponsor, to share whatever thoughts he has, and then we'll be holding this bill. Yes, sir.
I just have one other thing. So we've got one issue dealing with the age, and I have another issue that Andy has mentioned that I'd like to look at, too, so we have on the table focused our attention.
Please.
And that is the word permitted. I know most of
right.
you have been involved
right.
and had teenage children or been a teenager,
right.
and you know that you don't permit a teenager to do anything. They permit
right.
you to do something.
Yeah.
So I think
right.
that's a dangerous
right.
term.
Right. Right.
I was going to ask that question, but I did not.
That makes a lot
sure
of sense.
I'm
quite
gonna,
that old, yep.
And to venture into that, but I think it could almost be somewhat construed
yeah.
close toward the California
yeah.
Act that the mother was just brought up.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a problem there. I appreciate you bringing that to our attention, Max.
That's again a Hemingway spotted issue.
Okay, and why don't you in just really few words speak to the age difference issue, and then we're going to table this bill till next week.
Sure. I'm Andy Hemingway on committee staff. I spoke with the representatives of Senator Binkley's staff regarding this bill. With the same idea that there perhaps ought to be an age differential. And you're opposed to that idea. And the reason is that the genesis of this bill, as I understand it, is from a number of communities where bootlegging is a major concern.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently in some of those communities, there is a pattern of kids who are just over the age of 18 being aware of the fact that, in fact, if you're under 18, you get juvenile treatment and you don't get the same kind of treatment in the criminal system as you would if you were over the age of 18, and there is in fact, according to the senator's staff, a number of people out there who deliberately take advantage of that age differential in order to prevent those people who are caught from turning them in. In other words, you're under the age of 18, you're not threatened with a jail sentence, so there's not much recourse to make you turn in the over 18-year-old age person who in fact put you up to it. And their concern, I was quite surprised, was not so much from the point of view of that you're older and you're influencing younger people down a life of crime. It was the idea that you're evading detection because you use minors to do your dirty work.
And did they say anything about the age of the kids involved?
They indicated that it was commonly just very close in age, and they were opposed to any age differential at all. And I also spoke with Lori Otto, who was at one time the district attorney in that area, and she indicated that, in fact, from her experience, it is a real concern. So that's the reasoning why the bill came across in that fashion.
Opinion here, and why don't you give us some thought over the summer, and we'll see what we can come up with. Thanks a lot, Andy. Appreciate it. We'll take Senate Bill, we're going to change the order again and go past SB 86 for a moment. Is there somebody here to testify on 86? Do you have an extra couple minutes? Let's get 250. We're going to take testimony on the university confidentiality bill at this time. Would you care to join us?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're just taking a statement.
This is our introductory hearing for Senate Bill 250. Some members are not quite ready to act on this bill yet, so we're going to be holding it over the interim, but we want to get on the record the remarks of the university, and if you have, you know, if there is a rush or not a rush or a specific situation or whatever, you might want to advise us of your concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Wendy Redmond from the University of Alaska. This started out as, I thought this was actually quite a straightforward bill. It's turned out there are a lot of questions and issues which I think may be best served by working on them over the interim in order to answer the questions. I still feel it's a straightforward bill. Alaska is at this point the only state that we are aware of all 50 states that does not provide any kind of protection from public disclosure for research in progress. And that has become and will be becoming a greater problem in the future as research is now a very competitive industry, and it's a very large industry in Alaska. The University of Alaska brings in over $30 million a year of federal research money. And that money doesn't come to the university, it comes to individual faculty members through the university. Therefore, faculty members can take their money and go to any university they want. And if we're not able to provide a culture and an environment in which they can adequately get the protections they need for their research, we lose it. So it has become quite critical, as it's been brought to our attention by a couple of granting agencies as well as researchers themselves, that the potential for a lack of confidentiality in information is a problem. The language that was drafted in the bill that you have before you was drafted by the Attorney General's office. It was not our first choice for language. It seems a little clunky to me yet, and perhaps we can work on that over the session. It does, in fact, do what we need it to do. The section that was added in State Affairs was to respond to a concern that the university would not continue to be making public all of the information regarding which grants we are applying for, to whom we're applying, how much money we're receiving, and what the subject matter is. All of that information will and continue to be public information as it has always been. It was never our intention to try to deny access to that information. The difficulty with the Alaska statutes that no other state that we've found, that I have been able, and nor any of the 11 Western states, we do not define public record in a way that excludes notes and information that's pre-publishable, which is the most common way that university research in progress is able to be excluded from public information disclosure. In Alaska, I guess in effect, everything that's written on a piece of paper by any agency is public information, whether it's actually published or intended for public distribution or not.
Excuse me, that's not quite correct. Confidential and private correspondence remain protected, I believe.
Yes, confidential, if it's clearly marked in attorney-client privilege type information. I'd like to pass out to you, if I may, information that I think will be helpful as we review the bill, and it's copies of the statutory review that I think there are six states included there.
Do you have any extras?
Yes, I do.
Here, you
I should put a price on the bottom of that packet of information.
Well, not only a price, but I want to know where it was printed. And,
yes, and by what law.
That's right, and under what authorization. And where did you buy this paper, and where was it made? Was it made in Alaska?
That's a building.
You know, we have a lot of trees in Alaska, and I am not going to stand for out-of-state paper.
No,
no,
we got our own trees that died by
the shoot of white beetle. Actually, it's the bugworm.
It's the bugworm. We're all looking for
it. I'm sorry, Terry, but forgive me. When you told that story the other day, I had a gentleman in the industry who was on his way out of Haines about a decade ago, pointed up to that hill and said, "See all those trees there? 10 years from now, they're all going to be dead. That spruce budworm." And I don't know what to say, but the trees are still there.
Well, happily they did. I saw it made digest about 20 years ago. It happened in Juneau. I
shouldn't have done that.
A big wipeout of all the trees without showing me photos. But they let it be.
Well, I hope they made this paper out of those trees. Please proceed, and will the secretary please ignore the little conversation?
Mr. Chairman, if I may continue, and I'll make it very brief, I would be actually eager to entertain any concerns that the committee members may have so that I can sort of anticipate what some of those may be. We would like to get this passed early in the next session. I'm hoping over the summer we can come up with some elegant language. I think Oregon's is the clearest and most descriptive. It's very simple. It says simply, writings prepared by or under the direction of faculty of public educational institutions in connection with research until publicly released, copyrighted, or patented, are confidential. And hopefully that's what we had intended to go for. I think that's what we're seeking. The university is not currently engaged in confidential research, classified research. We're not engaged at the present time in any. However, classified research is covered under federal law and would be exempt from any provisions of this at any rate, I am told.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Greenberg?
No, yeah, Andy Hemingway will coordinate committee efforts on this. So any members that are interested, please contact us.
That's fine. I've got a couple of points I'd like to see addressed. First of all, on line 11, there's no definition of research.
Are you on the State Affairs?
I'm on the original bill. Do I need to look at the State Affairs again?
I believe it's the same, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, there's no definition there. I mean, if I open this packet and start looking at the bill, I'm conducting research as far as I'm concerned. And I don't believe that every inquiry by
anybody who happens to be associated with the university in some tangential way should be covered. You're talking about funded, authorized university research that is authorized under some procedure that the university uses to authorize its official actions. I think you'd want to say that so that there's no question here that if, you know, that somebody's bright idea while on faculty is somehow different from somebody's bright idea while off faculty. Down on the record section around line 18, I guess actually 19, it seems to me that if there is applicable federal law regarding intellectual property, then you don't need it, or if you do need it, there's something wrong with this reference. I don't see why you need a bill to do something that may already be covered under applicable federal law. So I'd like to ask you, I don't need it now, but as you provide your material to the committee, I'd like to understand what cases will fall under the applicable federal law and what cases will not, and I'd like language to make it very clear which is which. And finally, I don't really see why the university should be engaging in research that is secret, unless it is government research for classified projects. What this implies is that if I want to contract the university to do a private job for me, that you can keep it confidential. I don't think the university is a private contracting agency to take on people's research and withhold information from the public. So I've got some fairly strong objections to that language. Is a condition of the research grant that just basically means to me that if I give you enough money, I can get you to do my work and keep it from the public. I just can't relate to that. So I'd like to see some standards regarding confidential research, or else I'd like to see a prohibition against confidential research. This is the first time I've read the bill. Those are my first thoughts. I'd appreciate your considering them as you work with committee staff. Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chairman, on this confidential and secret, I was concerned, do you mean by secret, like war secrets and stuff like that?
I took that out.
Or industrial secrets and research secrets is extremely important, especially to the university. When they get some knowledge, and in most cases just stumbled on this thing that they can't believe. Man has not seen for
centuries. Right.
And so it's a secret.
Right.
We don't want this down because this is going to be tremendous.
Trade secret.
A trade secret for the university.
Right.
And it may be the lifeline of the university once we begin selling what we've found.
I don't disagree with that. What I was trying to say was, if the government is going to contract them to do a classified project, let them have a procedure so that you and I will know that this university is doing classified business with the U.S. government, and to the extent that is appropriate what the subject of that research is. Because maybe you don't want them doing research on certain things that you're sensitive about, or maybe I don't want them doing research on certain things that I'm sensitive about, and the public, since we own this university, I think should have, if not the right to know, at least the procedure that's in effect, you know, for making that decision. But that's just the government thing, you know. The other example...
You know, if you could give us an example, because, you know, we're heavily invested in UAF with machinery, with NASA and all kinds of things, and, you know, space research and this and that, someone may envision, well, someday we're going to have a war with Martians, and we don't want to get involved in the first place.
Terry, I'm not disagreeing with you here. All I'm saying is that if they're going to undertake classified research, they should have a procedure for deciding what is and what isn't, and what to do and what not to do. But your other example, to me, if a private party wants to use the university to do research for it, I think that the public has a right to know the subject of the research. I don't think they need to know the information if you know, there's a justification for keeping it confidential.
Yeah,
but if I were to ask, I mean, I could pick some of your favorite subjects or mine and say, do you want the university working on this without you being able to say, wait a minute, I don't want my university doing that kind of thing.
Yeah. Like
and
amoeba,
I think it's important, you know.
Amoeba is an animal. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, yeah, there are quite a number of amoebic issues like that. Is there any other question or comment? Mr. Davis has one, and then we'll move on.
Well, my question is, I think you bring up some legitimate concerns, Mr. Chairman, and ones that I frankly would have probably gotten from the first reading, but is there any reason why that kind of work can't be done? I mean, we need a whole interim to do this?
We need an appointment. I don't have a job yet.
I realize it's not a bill, so it's on its way to the floor, but what I'm saying is it something that you think is going to take extensive work?
Mr. Kerr?
Yeah. We've just started looking at this, Andy and I. And most of the research shows that in most states, they have a confidentiality sections in the public, in with the Public Records Act or nearby, and we have statutes all over the place on the thing. And to do it right, to bring it comprehensively to the committee, it's going to take a little bit of care. We can't do it in the next 48 hours. And we will commit to working on this over the interim so we can pass this thing out of this committee early in the session.
I'm not
trying to delay it.
Okay. I see that there's no...
Legally, when I read it, I could see there are a lot of issues in this little short thing.
Okay. All I can say, Wendy, is that I think it's an important thing, and I would urge you to work with these folks closely so that we can meet your schedule of getting it out very early next session.
I'll be right there. If we can meet at the university, I'll leave it up there in the summer.
There you go. Okay, thank you very much. And now we're going to move over to something else. Let's pick something fun. How about SB 86, Child Custody Determination? Could you advise Senate, let's see, what are we going to do about 204? Who is here to speak on 86? Please, join.
Carrie Dansby is on her way over.
She's on her way over.
Peter's here.
Senate Bill 86.
Yes, ma'am. As soon as I can just...
Clean one, take forward.
Okay. Please state your name for the record and share your thoughts on the bill.
My name is Barbara Miklas, and I'm the Executive Director of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And Senate Bill 86 was, the council instigated this bill and asked for the governor to ask that it be introduced. And what it does is it includes as a factor in making custody decisions any evidence of domestic violence, child abuse, or child neglect in the proposed custodial household or a history of violence between the parents. Right now there's two different aspects to custody statutes. One is shared custody and the other is other custody. And under the shared custody, there's already language that says a history of violence between the parents will be considered as a factor. What we originally wanted to do is make the two sections consistent and make sure that a history of violence was considered in both parts of it. And the Department of Law suggested that we could improve the language and include child abuse and neglect. And after checking with the Division of Family and Youth Services, we decided that we wanted to do that. So this legislation makes the two sections of the bill consistent and adds the language that I've already said. I'd be glad to answer your questions.
Any questions on Senate Bill 86? Everyone understand it? Looks like a great bill. Everybody like it? Anybody hate it? Can we move it?
Move it.
Mr. Ellis.
It doesn't have a mental clause in it.
No, sir, it doesn't have mental or anything.
There's no consensus.
No, no CS. We're working off the Senate Rules Committee.
I'm not unanimous consent. We sent along SB 86 with individual recommendations.
SB 86, a sent along with individual recommendations.
Good job, Bob. What a selling.
All right. Well, let's see. We have we've tabled 202, we've tabled 250, we've moved 86, we moved 123.
86?
And we moved 86, Max.
You know about the concurrent resolution?
Everybody loved it. There was no title change, there was no amendment. What do you mean?
Okay, we have this resolution, 75, res 43.
Oh, okay. You mean what to do next?
Yeah.
Andy, could you call Senator Farenstamp? I told her we'd give her 5 minutes' notice.
We can start on the corporation.
Let's start on 204.
Andy, I need your ear.
Yeah, who is it? So I can call. What's the number?
274. By
the way, you know, next year, as one of the council chairmen, I'm going to recommend that we use more speaker phones. I don't see that we need somebody.
Right, right on.
No way.
And you know, all we need to do is have more speaker phones.
That's all we need. We don't need somebody flicking buttons for us.
As a matter of fact, another thing I could do is tell people on their constituent teleconferences that they don't need a moderator either. Let them have their own staff sitting there and writing down.
Here's your phone. I think we can save a lot of money for doing that. I talked to Warren about that. I'm sorry to digress from your meeting.
I think we can we move forward while we're waiting?
Well, I don't know if we can or not. We haven't had a hearing.
No, I mean, I'm saying I can discuss it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm not moving any Senate bills without full disclosure. Let's see, we're not doing real well on this. Let's try again. Okay, Max, why don't you tell us what your thoughts are here? We're going to just give me 1 second to get this, Mr.
Glad that we're taking up the report card.
Good afternoon, Siri.
This is a representative call. Is Mark Erloff there?
Kurloff.
Kurloff?
Okay.
Whoever. Who is this? I can't read.
Kurloff.
K-R-O-L-O-F-F.
Thank you, dear. Kurloff. It's Mr. Kurloff.
Thanks. Now you're Bill Whitmore. And the attendants.
Make one more stab at it. Okay, we're going to go three more rings here and we're going to give up on this one.
Tell him to connect to David Wolf. They're both together.
All right.
I can isolate my concerns.
Very good.
Very quickly.
Very good.
Thank you for waiting. Cook Inlet Region.
There was no answer of Mr. Kurloff. How about David Wolf?
David Wolf?
Okay, sorry, they're wrong info.
About David's number.
Mark Kurloff is not answering his phone. Shall I assume he's not there?
He is here, but he is on his line. His secretary is just waiting for desk.
Well,
no one drew it yet.
Want me to page his secretary?
Would you tell her that the House Judiciary Committee is in a hearing that he wants to attend, and he's got about 30 seconds to get on the phone if he wants to participate?
Okay, please hold.
David Wolf's number is 276-5152.
Good. Terry, would you like to join us here at the table? Okay. Mr. Grunberg, what are your concerns regarding Senate Bill 204?
Okay. Do members have in front of them, then this is what they'll need. And let's not deal with this too. This melds in the amendment. So let's look at the CS for Senate Bill Judiciary, the Judiciary CS. The proposed amendments, the Bannister amendments, and the Bannister memo of April 25, those three documents. And I can go through very quickly. Well,
say those three again.
Okay, the first is the Senate Judiciary CS. The Judiciary CS. Okay? The second thing are the Bannister amendments on top. This is these amendments.
Right.
They look like this. It's a total of three pages. And the third thing is the sectional analysis dated April 25. To Pat Rhodes and Terry
Bannister. How about if we do it this way? Here is the bill that we addressed, and here is the amendment that we adopted to it. Could you tell us on what pages of this bill your amendments are going to occur?
You bet.
We haven't adopted this amendment.
Yeah, this amendment was adopted yesterday, and the work was completed on the bill. In the intervening period, Mr. Grunberg has come up with some issues he'd like to bring forward.
I have two questions. If you turn to the last page of the CS.
The last page of Senate Bill 204.
No, I'm talking about the long CS.
Well,
or the last page of the two amendments, the last page of this.
Let's just go with the last page of the bill which you want to amend, and then let's deal with the amendments.
Oh, let me deal with the amendments first once I got them up here. This one is a simple question.
Good afternoon, this is Pam.
Is Mark Kurloff there?
Yes, they tell me he's calling.
The House Judiciary Committee?
Thank you.
The whole committee.
The whole committee, each and every one.
Mr. Chairman, looking at the
we're all calling you, Mark.
What amendment?
Okay, you want me to start with the bill itself?
I want to know what you're changing before I see the change.
I'm not changing anything yet, I'm just raising issues.
All right,
and I'll tell you my concerns.
We have more copies than that.
This memo? Andy will run off the file copy. I'm going to read you everything that's a concern.
All right.
Okay. Section, my first concern, Mr. Chairman, is with Section 2. And
this is Representative Gall. I was advised that you wish to participate in the hearing on Senate Bill 204.
Yes, thank you.
It's happening now, sir. If you would just stand by, you'll find yourself in the middle of it.
Thank you, Representative Gall.
Andy, give that to the Secretary, because I need you to walk through this thing. The first thing is Section 2 on page 3 of the Senate Judiciary CS.
The question, how long will it take you to say this stuff? Do you want to do
Betty? Yeah, let's do Betty first.
Okay, Mr. Kurloff, if you could arrange something with your telephone people so that we can call you back and get to you quickly. It took about 5 minutes this time. We have a senator here who we agreed to interrupt this proceeding to hear her bill. It shouldn't take us very long at all, and I'll be calling you back if you could just let them know to expect us.
Yes, I can give a more direct number if that would be helpful.
Yeah, that would be good if you can give me a direct number.
Give it to one.
It would be 263-5155.
Thank you very much. We'll be back to you shortly.
About 10 minutes.
Thank you.
Senator, would you care to join us?
Meanwhile, they're Xeroxing the memo.
So you all have your good. And you can order your thoughts and paper through it quickly.
Senator,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please proceed.
Thank you, and I appreciate your consideration. I know all of us have the same busy schedule these days, so you know what it's like for me. I think you'll find that the joint resolution before you, number 43, is very straightforward. It is a resolution that I was asked to bring to the state of Alaska from the Council of State Governments. It's something that every state in the union is doing. At our annual meeting of the Council of State Governments, the Executive Committee took action on this resolution. And we're going through the various states of the union now with workshops and materials, trying to alert the states. You know, if we were having problems with the First Amendment, people's right to speak out, the journalists and people would be up in arms. What we're having trouble with today is the 10th Amendment. And that 10th Amendment, you have a copy of it in your packets. And what it does is give the states the rights to govern their affairs at any time that is not specifically set out through the Constitution of the federal government. And in the state's Council of State Governments booklet this month, and I made copies for all of you, the whole booklet is given to the disappearance of the 10th Amendment. And there's some great articles in there. I'd like to highlight for you, I know you don't have any time to read them now, but maybe on your plane travel this summer or sometime, you'll have a chance to look at it. There have been a number of court cases, and the Garcia case versus San Antonio, a metropolitan area, is one of the first cases that brought this to our attention to such a degree that it caused this much of an uprising. And that was where the Supreme Court did rule in favor of central governments. And it's all moving towards Washington State. But every article in this, and if you have, I've highlighted some. If any of you would like the marketed and highlighted section, I'll be happy to give it to you. And I very much appreciate the committee's work on the committee substitute, where you took the technical change on the bottom of line 29, page 1, and made that whereas. I don't know how. I just got to say we goofed. That was very well done, and I appreciate that very much on part of the committee.
Thank you, Senator. Does any member have a question first?
Yeah.
Mr. Martin?
No, I like what you've done in this long overdue, and especially the Garcia case, work everyone up. I was wondering, Senator, why you didn't go through another thing that I think NCSL has been pushing, that is in the 10th Amendment, with the change in the word powers not expressly delegated to the United States or reserved for the states. Oh, this is a big step forward, but I don't know if you knew about the other one.
Yes, I do, and I know that the governors, you know, the governors' conference is supporting this, as well as NCSL, as well as Council of State Governments. And the Council Gates, I just took the Council of State Government form that was approved by the Executive Committee. We were trying to keep as much, you know, as clean, clear, and precise as possible. And, you know, if there are amendments you want to add, that's fine, but I just preferred to have it go as it was recommended for us so that they can tell the states are all 50 states and the territories.
It is a big step in the right direction.
Excuse me, the Commonwealths. Are working together. They don't like to be called territories.
Further questions?
Do you want a motion?
I've got a couple. Senator, I'm a little concerned about the language in this third whereas clause. Maybe you could read it and tell me what it means. I'll show you what I don't like. It says the opinions hold that the states must find protection from the efforts of Congress to overrule state legislation through the political process rather than from constitutionally defined protection of the Constitution itself. I can't understand what that says.
It says that the 10th Amendment gives the states the authority, like to control over their banks, banking laws, etc. And it's not expressly given through the Constitution to the Congress. But the Congress, through adopting of legislation and regulations or attempting to control the actions of the states in all those areas, sometimes without the express work of Congress, but most of the time with the express work of Congress, and that's not taken into consideration laws that already exist within the state. And most of all of your, you know, your fishing, federal fishing game, your divisional parks, all the rest of them have their regs, et cetera. But they have to work with the states and with the state's regulations. And that's all brought about through the 10th Amendment. Some of those things are just being changed, seemingly at the will of Congress deciding, well, this is a good idea, so we'll just impose it on the state, so, whether we pay for it or not.
So would this language be equally good? I just found it real hard to understand, and maybe I was thinking of a way to maybe make it a little more direct. Whereas the opinions hold that the states must use the political process to find protection from efforts by the Congress to overrule state legislation rather than invoking constitutionally defined protection, or rather than invoking the protections of the Constitution itself, I guess actually is what I'd say. Is that okay with you?
To me, it says the same thing. It's a matter of style.
Yeah, it is. It doesn't change the intent at all. I just wasn't able to understand it the first two times I read it, and so I thought I'd see if I could make it a little easier for people who are not educated.
If that makes it easier for anybody to understand, I have no problem.
Makes it easier for me. It would read, whereas the opinions that hold that the states must use the political process to find protection from efforts by the Congress, I'm going to say by Congress, to overrule state legislation rather than invoking the protections in the Constitution itself. Okay. Mr. Grunberg.
I move the amendment.
Is there objection?
Can you read that one more time,
yeah,
please?
Whereas the opinions hold that the states must.
The opinions hold that the states must.
Then insert, use the political process to. Then it remains, find protection from efforts by. Remove the word by. Efforts by Congress to overrule state legislation, delete through the political process, rather than invoking...
Overrule state legislation
and then delete through the political process.
All right.
Rather than invoking the... Rather than add invoking the... Delete from constitutionally defined. Add an S to protection. We'd read, opinions hold the states must use the political process to find protection from efforts by Congress to overrule state legislation rather than invoking the protections in the Constitution itself. Okay. Amendment's been moved. There are no objections.
Mr. Chairman, I think technically we should move the CS amendment.
Okay, let's adopt the CS.
So moved.
For number 43 with the amended language that we just discussed. Okay. Ready? Any objections? House Senate resolution, joint resolution 43 is moved from committee with individual recommendations. Thank you, Senator. That's
I thank the committee and the co-chairs very much.
Our pleasure. Okay. Back to number 204. We'll call Mr. Corolla. What's that number for Abbott before I go? Yes, where's the show?
What do you want? I need the language. Peter's got it. I don't need that or not.
Coming right up.
Yeah. That won't work. Right?
Yeah.
I'm going to make a phone call.
Okay, now the bill you are looking for that I've misplaced is right here.
Hey,
keep going. Hi, scroll up this bigger ball. All right.
Can you hear us?
Yes, thank you.
Deb, would you just dial this number, and if you get a tape, hang up, but if you get a person, I need to talk to him.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Do you want me to look?
Yeah. Mr. Grunberg has some questions or recommendations or whatever CS or Senate Bill 204. Mr. Grunberg.
Yes. By preface, I'm not anxious to do anything that will damage the bill at all. I'd like to see the bill pass, but I do have some concerns. And if the members would look at Ms. Bannister's April 25 memo that you've just been given, and the Judiciary CS, and the amendments, the Bannister amendments, those are the three documents you need to have in front of you. My first question relates to Section 2. And as Ms. Bannister says in her memo, that the current content is designed to protect third parties from the ability of a corporation or shareholder to assert a derivative claim to evade liability for an act or undertaking of a corporate agent by claiming it was done without real authority. The amendment allows the corporation to assert limitations on the power of corporate agents set forth in the articles, but not to assert limitations found in its bylaws or board changes or board resolutions as a defense to the third party's claim. This change would protect shareholders to the extent that the articles of the corporation contain such limitations on either the nature of agency power or the manner of its exercise. This is a policy call, and what they're basically saying is you can immunize the corporation if you have that immunity in your in your articles, but not if you have it in a bylaw or in a resolution. The bill section is on page 3, lines 9 through 25. And what they've done is eliminate the term articles of incorporation. So in other words, they are not immunized, they are only immunized if these limitations are in the articles of incorporation. Is that not correct, Ms. Bannister?
Yeah, here's to get some.
Okay, and the question I have is why are we immunizing corporations when they have it in their articles of incorporation, but not if they have it in their bylaws or resolutions? But the unsuspecting public wouldn't look in your articles of incorporation anyway. I mean, how often, if you're going to deal with a corporation, do you say, I demand to see your articles of incorporation? And if you're going to say that, you're going to say, I'm going to look at your bylaws or resolutions too, if you're that sophisticated. And I'm wondering what the protection of the public is here, because they'll just put these limitations in the articles of incorporation, and the public won't look at it anyway.
This is the section of limitation on authority of corporate agents.
You bet. Did I not state that correctly, Ms. Bannister?
I'm just looking it over right now.
Mr. Hemingway.
Well, I'm sorry. Let me just read that.
Maybe you can explain it better.
Everybody just look at the language for a minute without saying anything just for a minute. Okay?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, did I have it backwards?
If it's in the articles, you can assert it.
No, he said it right. He said that it can only be done if it's in the articles. At least that's what I thought.
It would be more public because they're on record.
I understand. You're saying that the corporation can disavow actions of its agents if it says so in the articles.
Well, I'd like you to show me where it suggests that in this language.
Line 13.
Well, I see it says that a limitation upon the powers of the shareholders, officers, or directors, or the matter of exercise of
may not be asserted. That's all. The active language is may not be asserted on line 15.
Oh, I hadn't gotten down in there yet. Taken or implied by the bylaws, or by the board, or by shareholders. I guess I'm sorry. I don't understand.
Let me explain once again. This statute basically says you may not assert a certain defense.
Well, but you're going to have to get to there by first saying what it does say, and then
it's a negative.
Well, I don't see the word defense. So
no, it says may not be asserted. That means that you may not raise it as a defense.
Well, or implement it either, right?
What the statute presently says is certain things may not be asserted as a defense.
I don't see the word defense or any relation to it.
May not be asserted as between the corporation and a shareholder or a third person.
What does that mean? Well, I'd like on the record someone to tell me what that means. May not be asserted as between. Doesn't that mean that you cannot say that this limitation found in the bylaws cannot be construed to be binding between the corporation or a shareholder unless something, except in a proceeding by a shareholder or to dissolve the corporation or by the corporation or by the shareholder suing?
Let me explain. If you look at the little summary, what they're talking about are shareholder lawsuits, basically, or suits against the corporation. And the purpose of this section, as in current law, is to state that you may not raise it as a defense if the if there's a limitation upon the agent's authority in the articles, bylaws, or resolutions, they can't raise that as a defense. See, what corporations have customarily done is said, wait a minute, this guy is acting in this course and scope because we have this little clause here in the bylaws, or we have this little clause in a resolution. And that's an absolute defense. You can nail him, but you can't get the corporation.
I see. So you're saying that you would like it to read, they're saying here that if the corporation is somehow freeing itself from liability of the action of its officers in the articles of incorporation, that would be appropriate, whereas current law says that wherever an entity tries to free itself from this liability, it cannot do so. Is correct. That correct?
Correct.
You're exactly right.
Does every member of the committee clearly understand that?
That's a policy call. I am raising issues I spotted that I thought people would be interested in. And I'm going to raise, in my own view here, is that for most people, they're not going to look at the Articles of Incorporation. The Articles of Incorporation are on file with the Department of Commerce. And that's why this is a matter of public record, and that's the policy behind it. And I'm simply raising it. That's an important change, and I wanted the committee to know that.
Okay. Does anybody wish to raise a public policy justification for suggesting that Mr. Gruenberg is wrong in implying that the Articles of Incorporation should not be used to free a corporation from responsibility for the action of its employees or officers?
I'm not making an amendment. I'm just raising it so you know what the bill contains.
Well, if an amendment of that sort were made, is there anybody on the phone or present who wishes to raise a public policy justification for not moving in that direction? Mr. Martin.
If you don't have it in your article of corporation or in your bylaws, where could an average guy or person who maybe wouldn't buy stock find it?
That's it.
Or it has to be one or the other. Why not both?
It could be in a prospectus, it could be in the contract, or whatever.
But at least the basics, I think most people who would want to get into the corporation one way or the other would ask for the bylaws or the corporation, the articles of the corporation. Couldn't you have it in both?
That's the theory. You've stated the theory. I am raising it. I don't have a feeling one way or the other. I just wanted to raise it to you and get the call.
I think it's important to raise and show, you know, new law would give a person a fair chance in both places, not in both places.
Does anybody have any problem if we were to delete this language? Delete section 2?
No.
I move we delete the, I don't want to delete section 2 because there are these wars and buys and stuff. But to delete the Articles of Incorporation language on
that's the only thing it does, Mr.
I think that's all it does. The others were just to...
Nice.
Well, they were just kind of technical changes. I don't think they really need to be in there.
Mm-hmm.
Very
Mr. Chairman,
technical.
This bill contains a number
Go ahead.
This bill contains a number of standalone provisions. Each issue I raise, if you don't like, we just strike the section. That's general. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So moved, then, or would you make a motion to that effect?
So moved.
Is there any objections? Hearing none, section 2 is deleted.
The one thing, Mr. Chairman, I want to be sure is this doesn't kill the bill and then check this.
Yeah, I mean, if there are, well, we're going to move the bill after we're done with this discussion, so.
The next thing I have is, this is okay, right? Okay, the next thing I have is section 16. Section 16, as you state, Mr. Bannister, is to changes the insolvency test. The page reference is pages 8 and 9, starting on page 8, line 26. Changes the insolvency test. Allows existing directors to make a distribution and then determine whether the distribution did in fact render the corporation unable to meet its current debt. If it does, the corporation could theoretically recover the illicit dividend from the shareholders. So in other words, it flips it around, allows a corporation basically to bankrupt itself at the expense of the creditors, as I understand it. And I have some concerns about this.
I understand that. It seems to me it says a corporation may not make a distribution.
Look at Terry's memo. This is the synopsis.
Well, but I'm going to first try to read it from the language. It seems as if it says that a corporation may not make a distribution if the distribution
or as a result of the distribution, the corporation would be unable to meet its liability. So it seems to me that it's a direct prohibition. It's weakening the prohibition because it used to say might be unable. Now it just would be unable. I don't understand the effect of the change.
Okay. It's a question of foreseeability.
Yeah.
And the current language in the law says that you may not distribute your assets if it would make it unlikely that you could be unable, make it likely you would be unable to meet the liabilities. And makes it easier for you to divest your assets, and the people who will be left holding the bag are the creditors.
Comments?
I have serious problems with this section.
Comments by anybody? Mr. Martin?
Well, I kind of agree with that. I agree with you, Mr. Chairman, in that the Section 16 pleaders may not feel safe with it, but the explanation makes me realize that it's doing just the opposite, making it feel like it's doing the opposite, whereas the existing directors may make the distribution and then discover.
That's what the amendment would do. I mean, that's what the existing language would do.
Yeah, but I don't mind Section 16 as it is worded now.
You mean or existing
law? I feel safer
law.
With it, yeah.
Okay. I don't like the amendment the bill does.
Right.
I'd rather keep the language the way the law is.
I'm the opposite from it. This reminds me of the savings and loan the way the law is now. They're right up here that Terry had given us. It says, allow the existing directors to make the distributions and then determine whether the distribution did, in fact,
no,
render the corporation
unable. That's what the bill would do. That's what the bill would do. By taking out likely to be, I guess it's a judgment call as to how strongly it would do so, but the interpretation that's being given is that by taking out the phrase likely to be, it says you can find out after the fact, and then you can go back to your shareholders and ask them for their money back, rather than being required to make an assessment prior to the distribution.
Or not to make the distribution at all.
Yeah, with the likely to be, it basically says if this could lead to that risk, you have a fiduciary, I guess,
okay, so this is you want to leave the likely to be.
Yes, sir,
that.
That's what Mr. Grunberg is suggesting.
Okay.
Seems right to me.
I'll look
at that. Did you move that?
I move to strike Section 16.
Okay, strike Section 16 would be Amendment Number 3, their objection. Well, the adopted amendment number 1 yesterday, that big amendment. So, Dad, this was amendment 3. The last little one was amendment 2.
Okay, I want to raise another issue.
Yes, sir.
I'm simply raising an issue. It's found in a number of sections, starting with section 20. And these all shorten the period of time required for notice of various meetings. And Section 20 is for shareholders. That's the meeting of everybody who owns any shares in a corporation. Presently, it's 20, at least 20 days, and this will make it at least 10 days. And that may be good, in my opinion, for a small, closely held corporation, but for a large corporation, when Alaska is one-fifth the size of the United States, you may have people coming from all over the place. That's not necessarily a lot of time, particularly when coupled later in the bill that says they can meet anywhere they want, and I'll bring it up later, whether it's inside the state or out. Hmm. And I'm raising that. You're going to find this is the first section in which this appears, and there are a number of sections, and that's the main thing it does. And I want to raise that to you, because I think that's a decision you need to know that the bill does.
Mr. Taylor?
Mr. Martin?
I wonder if we, that let us know, it seems to me about 5 years ago we had this, and we changed the statute from a longer period of time, whether it be 45 or 30. There was a lot of debate on the floor whether we should go lower, and I think that's the.
Sorry, Karen.
Yeah, I think past experience told us in our debates, not even 4 years ago, that this is low enough because it was 30 or 45 days. Shugart Collective was having problems, and the Native Corporation, more than anything else, were having a lot of problems making it too long. But then we went to be somewhere fair, and we studied the mail. And it takes 7 days sometimes within Alaska to get from Anchorage to Juneau, and we studied this, we studied that. So there wasn't a lot of involvement in it.
So you support the 20?
I'd like to go with 20, because I want those people to have a fair chance. And how long does it take to get the letter to Haynes from here?
It can take me, in my district, to get a letter to Prince of Wales Island. My average is 5 to 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir.
Where you live, way out there, eastern Siberia.
I live just off the wall where you come from.
Is this
Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I'd like to strike that from the record.
I think we better strike that from the record.
You know, we have grown-ups in the audience here. We're going to have to kind of...
Well, it's been a tough session, Mr. Chair.
But we have a good report.
We're winding down.
Mr. Chairman, my question is, would it be possible to split the difference here and say 10 days within state and 20 days out of state?
That's pretty tough. Because they have a mass mailing, they have to be consistent.
But it just seems to me that you could make a meeting within the state a lot easier and faster than you could make a meeting out of state.
Well, gentlemen, I was just reflecting on what I'm hearing here. The existing law is 20. It is, as Mr. Martin said, been debated and discussed quite a bit. This is not the corporation code, you know. This is an amendment to the corporation code, but the bill itself that we were talking about having go into effect at a certain date, that's already been passed.
Yes.
These are amendments to that, and the desire to avoid the difficulties in the corporation code, which had led to the other motion to delay it, we're hoping to resolve here. If these changes do not, you know, create serious hardships, all we're doing is sort of staying with the status quo, and, you know.
I guess my point would be, Mr. Chairman, that perhaps the status quo isn't good enough in terms of modern telecommunications, and you know, we do not want our corporations to be operating at a disadvantage when a speedy meeting or decision is necessary. So, you know, if there's an option that we can offer them, I think it's in our interest as well as theirs.
I guess my own experience has been, this is the first time I've thought about this in relation to this bill, but most of my corporate correspondence is requesting a proxy vote, and for me to receive, let's say it's sent to my legal residence, which is what happens to me. If I get a bank statement, I don't get it until about 2 weeks after it's been mailed by the bank. Because first it goes up to Haynes, then it sits around in that mailbox, then it gets forwarded to me here, and I'm lucky if I can respond in a timely fashion to anything that gets sent to my home address. If I have to then fill out that proxy and return it, I'm not going to be able to make the deadline under 10 days. But, you know, my own concerns are secondary. I have to agree with what Max is saying, that technically in Alaska, unless you are at your place of residence, and I think it's true, it's going to be awfully difficult to make that deadline.
So I think the major emphasis here is in Alaska. People move and travel so much, and you always have to mail for the mail. I have it easily 14 days for my mail from Anchorage to get down here. For whatever reason, they usually pack it on Mondays and Fridays. And so I'm entitled to notice. Other people, business people, travel all the time. I'd hate to, you know, you talk about modernization, you talk about computers and Zap mail, laser beams and everything else, but there's nothing like that basic thing that you had to sign a piece of paper and send it back. And it takes time.
Well, there's 20, 25, 26, 30 pages of good stuff in here. I'm sure we can.
Yeah, I've isolated this down. This is an issue that will come up again.
That's what I guess I'm saying, that there's still, you know, 28 pages of things in here, and this is a matter that could be postponed, you know, and discussed next session in a separate piece of legislation.
Mr. Chairman, I am concerned because we have a relatively unsophisticated population. We're not on Wall Street or in Beverly Hills. Thank goodness.
You're off the Wall Street.
Yes, off the Wall Street.
There is an off the Wall Street.
Yes.
Oh, Lord.
Wall Street is there. You ain't on Wall Street.
So I'm just wondering, I hear people from the corporate world here, would there be any major problem to leave for 20 days? Is that causing problems to you? Yeah.
Having no serious objections being raised by anybody, and anyone who wishes to raise one should say so now. There is a possibility of a motion on the subject then. Mr. Grunberg, you wish to move it?
Yeah, I think we should probably, I with some trepidation, say I think we should move section.
And I would say that, you know, the matter can certainly be dealt with at a future time. Ms. Bannister, then Mr. Martin.
I haven't finished, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Grunberg.
Yeah, but I think actually to be technically correct, we should go back to 20 on line 23 of page 10, but the language on page 11, lines 3 and 4, is technical language to make it drafted correctly. Is that not right? So I'm not going to leak section.
That's right.
We're different.
Yeah.
No, we're different things. better to take it up.
Okay, but before we get to that now, did you have something about the 10-day, 20-day?
Yes, I just wanted you to make the amendment broad enough to cover everywhere it pops up.
Well, we'll go through the bill section by section, because there are different kinds of notices.
Oh, okay.
And I don't want to just do it broadly. This is the shareholder. This is the most basic notice.
Hello? Yeah, we're still with you. I just have you on mute for a minute. I'm just chatting with you. Okay, we'll talk.
Okay, so my amendment is simply...
Well, let's start with the section that you're discussing. Notice of shareholder meetings on line 23, remove the change, restore the 20.
Mm-hmm.
On page 11, line 10, same action. Page 11, line 18...
Wait.
Yes, same
that's
action.
Right. That's right.
I'm not going to say it unless I'm sure.
Right.
What do you want to do with
my next motion, Mr. Chairman? My next motion, page 11. I believe there we can just eliminate section 21 entirely because that's all that's in there. It's in there twice on page 10 and line 18. So it's to strike section 21.
All right.
So the motion is to strike 21.
Now, Deb, what we've got here is the motion, which we're still developing here, is on page 10, line 23. We restore the 20 days. On page 11, lines 9 through 24, we delete section 21 and renumber sections accordingly. And Mr. Gruenberg.
Just so the record is correct, Mr. Hemingway has pointed out something correctly, that the new corporations code we passed last year changed the law. Prior, it was 10 days. Under the new law, it's 20.
Yeah. We moved the first two sections. We'll get into discussion when we're done with the motion. Do you have anything you want to do on line 27, Mr. Gruenberg?
I'd like to take, these are separate motions. I just wanted the people to realize where we were. So my motion is to strike section 21.
All right. So the motion is to strike, is to restore the 20 days on line 23. Yeah,
I'm going to make them separate motions.
Well, then make the first motion.
Okay, my first motion is to restore the 20 days, page 10, line 23.
Any objections? Hearing none, that is done. The second motion was to delete section 21. Hearing no objections, that is done. Mr. Gruenberg, line 27, you wish to take action there?
Yes, absolutely. We have to do that to conform.
In that case, you are moving to delete section 22?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Gruenberg has moved amendment number... Let's just get this straight here. I'm just going to go back for a second. Deb, the first thing we did was amendment number 2. That was the deletion of section 2. Then amendment number 3 was the deletion of section 16. Then amendment number 4 was the restoration of the 20 days on line 23, page 10. Amendment number 5 was the deletion of section 21. Amendment number 6 was the deletion of section 22. And unanimous consent went with all of those. Mr. Gruenberg?
Yes, and I just wanted to put on the record what I said a minute ago.
It is on the record.
Okay. The next thing is section 39. And that appears back here at page 20. And this is going to appear twice in the bill. This is the first time. And if you look at Terry Bannister's memo, what she says, and I'm going to read it. It follows the suggestion of the ALR...
I'm sorry, before you do that, could somebody say what this section means?
I'm going to do that. May I do it?
Yes, sir.
Okay. This follows the suggestion of the American Law Institute's statement on corporate governance. Articulates what's called the business judgment defense for directors of a corporation. No jurisdiction has to this point ever attempted a statutory formulation of the business judgment rule. And what this thing does, Mr. Chairman, is the following. It says, if you sue a director and you state that they have violated their fiduciary duty and acted illegally, it is a defense that they acted in what's called business judgment, exercising sound business judgment. This, for the first time in any state, will set that forth in a statute rather than the case law. And it says that, and I don't have a problem with that, but I do have a problem with some of the language that they use in it.